This is a CBC podcast.
Hi there, I'm David Cochrane, and this is the Power and Politics podcast for Thursday, April 25th. Canada's race to build electric vehicles shifts into high gear as Honda announces a record $15 billion investment in the auto sector. Coming up, how Ottawa and Ontario plan to ensure this big bet pays off. Plus, an Ontario MPP is asked to leave the provincial legislature for wearing a keffiyeh, a request she refused. The Power Panel weighs in. We begin with what the federal and Ontario governments are calling a game changer for Canada's auto industry. Together, they announced Japanese automaker Honda is investing $15 billion to build four new manufacturing plants in Ontario. They'll assemble electric vehicles and make the components that piece the vehicles together. The deal includes both federal and provincial money. Ottawa will provide an estimated $2.5 billion in tax credits, and Ontario will match that more or less through direct and indirect incentives. François-Philippe Champagne is the Federal Minister of Innovation, Science and Industry, and he joins me now. Minister, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me, and you know, great to be on the factory floor here in Alliston.
Yeah, every time we do an interview now, Minister, it's at a noisy place, and this one is going to be a pretty busy place after the announcement today. It's $2.5 billion from the federal government in this supply chain investment tax credit that was announced in the budget. Should we now conclude this was designed specifically for Honda when it was put in the budget a week or so ago?
Listen, this is an historic day for Canadian workers. As you said, this is the single largest investment in the auto industry. It is the largest investment by Honda in their 75 years history. Listen, it's just a testament to the quality of workers we have in Canada. You're right. You know, we've put in place programs that would make sure we can attract these investments. But let me tell you, what is attracting these investments is really the quality of our workers. And I went there 2 years ago. I was with the chairman of Honda in Tokyo. And I remember at the time I was pitching Canada, our workers, our critical minerals, renewable energy, access to market. And he said, Minister, I heard you. Just be patient. And I can tell you today, this was patience well rewarded, because what you have now is an anchor investor that's going to have rippling effects for generations. You're talking about thousands and thousands of jobs, because it's not only about one plant. This is going to be four different plants that are going to be here. And obviously, it's going to have a rippling effect to the entire supply chain. Because as you may recall, when I started as industry minister, there were some people wondering, would that be the end of our auto sector? And obviously now we've seen that this is the rebirth of the auto sector. We see companies like Honda doubling down, tripling down on Canada, Volkswagen, GM, Ford, Stellantis. Listen, the workers behind me, I can tell you, David, they've never been more happy. They understand that we believe in them, the nation believes in them, Honda believes in them, and we're going to lead this EV manufacturing here in Canada.
So, Minister, it's the full meal deal from Honda, right? It's a battery plant, it's a vehicle assembly plant, and it's other components feeding into the supply chain. And you're only on the hook for about $2.5 billion in tax credits there. If you look at the Volkswagen deal you did in St. Thomas, it's up to $13 billion in production subsidies. So do you reconsider the value of those deals for just a battery plant when you look at the benefit you're getting for a much smaller investment here today?
Well, I would say everything is different. All these deals are different. This is the biggest deal we've done on very competitive terms. What you have to appreciate also is that when we started to position Canada as a destination of choice for these battery investment, the Inflation Reduction Act in the United States was there. We said at the time from the get-go, we would be strategic, we'd be limited, we would choose our partners. But obviously, when you look at the investment of Honda, by the time they come online, the investment tax credit in the United States, the IRA, would be largely at the end of the subsidy period. So it's a different deal. But it's a great deal for Canadians, because each of these deals are feeding on each other to build. Because it's not just about Honda or Volkswagen or Stellantis, GM and Ford. It's about the entire supply chain in the country. When you see, when the world see that a company which is as highly regarded as Honda choosing Canada after Dow Chemical in Alberta, after BHP in Saskatchewan, after Nordvolt in Quebec, it sends a very, very strong message that we are the place to invest in the world.
So, Minister, on this, about 1,000 jobs is what Honda is saying across the four different locations that are associated with this announcement today. But there's going to be a construction phase and a construction component of this. And with the Stellantis arrangement, there's been criticism that a lot of the jobs associated with this, despite big Canadian subsidies, are going to non-Canadian workers. And people, I think, were surprised to learn after the fact on some of the earlier deals that there was a foreign worker component to it. What's the foreign worker component for the Honda arrangement that you've agreed to here? What percentage will it be? What numbers will it be?
I would say, let's put things in perspective, you know. By the way, we work very well with CBTU. We're on the same side. I've been talking to CEO of Stellantis in North America. When you're talking about foreign worker on construction side, you're talking about 72 people out of 2,000 construction workers currently, and more than 5,000 that are going to be operating at the Stellantis plant. So let's make sure that we keep things in perspective. My job is to maximize jobs for Canadians. Obviously, that's what we do. That's what we do with Stellantis. That's what we're doing, obviously, here with Honda. But let's be clear, this is more than 1,000 jobs. This is tens of thousands of jobs for, you know, the next 30, 50 years, because, you know, it's not only about the jobs today, but the jobs you're creating for generations to come. There's folks in the line that told me, Minister, my son or my daughter will be able to work here, and probably their son and daughter, because when you make an investment of that magnitude, remember the word of the CEO of Volkswagen, who said, when you invest something like, in their case, was around $7 billion, this thing you're talking 15, he said, we're going to be here for a century. And just to give a perspective on numbers, you know, because I know you like that, David, but just look at their current operation. The plant you're seeing here and what they do, over the last 10 years, they've invested north of $15 billion already in salaries and in their supply chain. So imagine when you bring another four plants that are going to come here. This is going to have rippling effect not only in Alliston and Ontario, but across the nation. This is really building for the future. And I think, you know, as Canadians, we don't celebrate too often. We're humble. But today it's really to give, you know, every workers you see, you should give them a tap in the back and say good job, because, you know, thanks to their expertise right behind me, they're the ones who won what we have today. They make us win. Those are the workers who make us win.
No, Minister, I appreciate all of that. And we heard similar things in the other announcements. But what we didn't hear at that time was the temporary foreign worker component. And I appreciate your argument. It is a small percentage of the whole, but it's something we all learned about after the fact. And it caused a little bit of controversy. So where is that in this arrangement? Is it going to be a similar thing where Honda needs to bring workers over from Japan or from other countries with their partners to set up certain equipment? What will those numbers be? I mean, is that settled? Do we know what that would be?
But, David, if I may, there's nothing new in that. The workers know that. I mean, we had Canadians working south of the border. We had people south of the border coming in Canada when you have these plants. When these plants are being built, you need to adjust equipment to maintain warranty. You need, you know, we've been doing that for decades. And we send people abroad. Some people come. We know these things. And that's why we've been working with the unions to make sure that we maximize that in the construction phase. CBTU is talking to Honda as they're talking to Stellantis. Listen, we're all on the same side on that. There's no space between us. We're working with CBTU. We're working with the unions. We all want the same things. And the workers know that. You know, these folks know that. Some of our guys have gone abroad as well. So they know that how these things operate, and we're going to maximize jobs for Canadians. That's our mission. That's what we do.
Okay. I'm raising it only because the Canada's Building Trades Union have raised it in association with the other plans. And I know you say you're dealing with them, but they've raised concerns about it. So I was just trying to get some clarity on how it may apply here. But
I appreciate it.
Yeah. So I wonder.
But you should look at their current statement. They're very happy of what we're doing together. There was the letter, but you look at their latest statement. They know we put them. We've been working with them. I've been talking to them. My team has been working with them. We're all in this together. We all want the same thing. There's no division there. We all want the same thing. We're working on the same direction. And look at their latest comments. They know we are on the same side on this.
So, Minister, you've gone all in on electric vehicles as an industrial policy and as an investment sector by the government. And you still have the electric vehicle adoption targets that you're hoping to hit as a country. And there is skepticism about that because of softer markets and slower uptake on electric vehicles, driven in some cases, people argue, by a lack of charging capacity. The last time we spoke was before the budget, and it was when the Ford announcement had been made in Oakville that they were delaying things for a couple of years. I don't see a big new investment in charging capacity in the federal budget. Do you need to do that if this plant and these investments are going to pay off, not just in the job creation, but in the electric vehicle adoption this country has set for its emissions reduction targets?
It's a very good question, David. And I think the destination is clear. You know, we're going towards EV vehicle. I feel a bit like Model T with Ford at the time. The destination is clear. This is where the world is going. Now, different manufacturers will go at different speed. I think today it's a big vote of confidence when you have a Honda, which is not doubling down, but tripling down, almost quadrupling down on Canada. It sends a very strong signal. In the plants they're going to be building, they're going to be producing to 140,000 electric vehicles a year. So this is, if anyone had any doubt, you should just watch the press conference and talk to or listen to the CEO of Honda. We came from Tokyo to say that. On the charging infrastructure, definitely we need to do more. The province, the municipalities, because the destination is clear. And we're going to be working with them to make sure we have that. But today's a great catalyst to say Canada is at the forefront of this electric vehicle manufacturing revolution. And I think it's sent a wonderful signal that Canada is attracting record investment after, you know, BHP in mining in Saskatchewan, Dow Chemical in Alberta, Nordvolt in Quebec. Listen, the world is taking notice that, you know, the place to be is Canada. They recognize that we have the best workers. The folks behind me, I trust you. If we have an announcement today, it's because of them. And we're going to continue to support them in every step of the way.
I wonder, Minister, there's an election in a year or so, if the calendar holds, about 18 months from now maximum. The Conservatives have been critical of these deals that you've done with some of the auto companies, in particular because of the foreign worker component that we talked about earlier. I wonder how ironclad and secure the government support for these investments are, and therefore the project itself, given if the next election doesn't go your way. Is there language there? And will it be all finalized before the election cycle begins in earnest in Canada to secure this investment that you're announcing here today?
Well, there's no wonder there was no Conservative here this morning, believe it or not. If they were to say to these folks that they don't believe in their future, I hope they're not going to walk anywhere close to that. These people believe in their future. We believe in them. We believe in Canadians. We believe in investing. I mean, it's shocking that anyone would say, the world is celebrating what we're doing. You're talking about creating tens of thousands of jobs for the next century. This is amazing. I mean, I cannot imagine anyone in his right mind not being celebrating Canadian workers today. Today, we're celebrating every auto worker in the country and everyone in the supply chain because folks who work, the people who are on the assembly line understand this is not about slogan or picture. These guys work. They understand. They said, Minister, what you do today is going to secure a job for centuries. So this is a great thing. And like I said, that's why we provided a very stable and predictable environment for investments. It's true in the auto sector. It's true in artificial intelligence. It's true in mining. It's true when it comes to cement and what we've been attracting in terms of other investment across the country. Listen, if there's anyone who doesn't get it, let them speak between themselves. But come here and talk to folks. They'll tell you that the future is right here, right now.
You said, Minister, just as a final point, that in our conversations in the past and again today, that you say you need to be targeted and strategic and limited, and you couldn't go out and chase every possible project because you just couldn't fund the subsidies for all of it. So should we look at this Honda announcement, as significant as it is, as maybe the last of these big auto announcements by your government? Or is there the potential for a Toyota, which is, you know, sniffed around, or another company that you might be doing something with? Or is this the end of it?
Well, you know me by now, David. I talk to everyone. When I started, we didn't have one. And now we have four or five, and we're counting. Clearly, you know, the big decisions have been made by most of the automakers. Volkswagen chose Canada, GM, Ford, Stellantis, Nordvolt, and now we have Honda. So I would say, you know, you're going to see one or two of these plants in North America. And I would say Canada has been punching above its weight, and it's thanks really to the folks behind me. So obviously we're engaging with everyone. What I think now we're going to be doing is building the supply chain around, and that's going to be, you know, it's really a turnaround for the auto sector like we've never seen before. To think that in 2024 we could attract the largest single investment. Just a few years ago, no one would have believed that, but, you know, we made it. You know, the ones which are working behind me made it. You know, we win because of talent. We win because of them. And today, I think not only Alliston, Ontario, but the whole country is winning. And that's a great success story that it's going to pay dividends for generations to come.
Okay, so that's where we should expect the focus to be now in the supply chain buildup, in building the industries and companies that feed into these big announcements?
Yeah, I mean, if you talk to people like, you know, Flavio Volpe of the auto parts manufacturers, other people in the auto sector, they understand that when you have an anchor investors like that, you're going to build the whole ecosystem. That's why we did an aerospace in Montreal. That's what we're doing in the auto sector here. That's why I say this is not just about Honda, but it's about the thousands of jobs that are going to be created. Because, you know, when you see a company investing so much, that means it gives confidence to others to follow suit. And that's why I'm so hopeful about what we've seen today. Really a generational investment that, you know, people will be talking about for decades to come. And certainly the folks behind me, I can tell you, they believe in their future, we believe in their future, and we're going to be working with them.
Minister Champagne, thank you for joining us today. Appreciate the time.
Thank you, David.
Japanese automaker Honda has announced a multi-billion dollar electric vehicle investment in Ontario. It's a record number for Canada's auto industry, worth $15 billion, and it means four new manufacturing plants and 1,000 more jobs. Both the federal and Ontario governments will put $2.5 billion in subsidies on the table for the automaker.
This is a historic day with the largest auto investment in Canada's history. We will be investing to create Canada's first comprehensive electric vehicle supply chain from start to finish.
Honda's new facilities will strengthen our electric vehicle supply chain, securing and creating thousands of new paying jobs across our province. This is generational. This is decades and decades down the road.
Vic Fedeli is the Ontario Minister of Economic Development, Job Creation and Trade, and he joins me now. Minister, welcome back to the show.
Wonderful to be here, David. Thank you.
So, Minister, you work for a premier named Ford. Today you're doing a deal with a company named Honda. It's $2.5 billion that we know about. Is that the full extent of the taxpayer commitment from Ontario to this arrangement?
Yeah, look, this is a very meaningful day for families here in Alliston and for Honda and for all the people in Ontario. We're making an investment in the neighborhood of $2.5 billion in direct and indirect incentives, matched by the federal government's tax credits of around the same $2.5 billion.
I wonder, though, Minister, in the past, when you've done deals with electric vehicle battery plants, there were production subsidies at the back end. Will there be production subsidies for Honda, or is this $5 billion the total commitment from the two levels of government here?
Honda's investment is $15 billion. And there are no further investments from the province or the feds other than what was announced today. There's no back-end subsidies. Honda's here because this is the right place to be. You know, a lot of companies that were looking at those U.S. subsidies, I think they've realized now that you're going to make a 50-year decision based on 1 or 2 years of subsidies in the States. It's not worth it when you can come here to Ontario for the talent, the clean energy, the land, all of the critical minerals. We have everything here in Ontario to build an electric vehicle. So that's why they're here. There are no further subsidies.
Okay, so on this, in terms of the jobs that are being created, I mean, compared to the past battery deals, this looks like better value for money, not to criticize the other arrangements, but given the full scope of this and the lower outlay, this seems like a better arrangement for taxpayers. So Honda's estimating it's 1,000 new jobs for the EV and the EV battery manufacturing facilities. Where do you see the spin-off of that in the supply chain and these two other as yet to be announced locations that are part of this deal?
So, David, the $15 billion announcement by Honda is for four plants. Mm-hmm. So it is for a vehicle assembly plant here in Alliston, a battery plant here in Alliston, a joint venture with a company called POSCO from Korea, and they will make a cathode, and that's in a city that will be announced shortly. And it's also a joint venture with a Japanese company called Asahi Kasei, in a community that will be announced later. So the $15 billion and the $5 billion in incentives covers all four of those plants. So the 1,000 jobs that are created here in Alliston and the jobs that will be announced in those other two communities, that's already included in the dollar value that both Honda has made today and the province and the feds.
Okay, so the total job creation outside of construction for all four facilities is 1,000. Am I understanding that correctly, Minister?
No, the 1,000 is only here in Alliston. The amount of jobs to be created in the other two communities, we want to announce those in those individual communities to give those communities something to celebrate as well. But the price tag for those is already included in the $15 billion and in the $5 billion in incentives.
Okay, I got you on that point. But so help me out here. You want to announce those in those other communities. I'm assuming that means they have been picked.
Yeah.
There are dates for those announcements. When are we going to know the more specific details on where these other facilities are going to go?
You'll know those shortly. We're just making final arrangements of trips from Japan, trips from Korea, to make those two announcements in those other communities and to join their local mayors and suppliers. So again, you know, this is a $15 billion announcement, not just to create 1,000 jobs, but those other two cities, the amount of jobs. There are quite substantial jobs in those other two communities as well, are all in that, in the initial investment announcement.
Okay, so Minister, the last news we had on the electric vehicle industry in Ontario wasn't good news. It was the further delay of the Ford retooling at its Oakville plant for the building of electric vehicles. When you look at that delay in Oakville versus this announcement here in Honda, where does that tell us where this sector is going and where the market is for these vehicles? Because Ford is responding to a lower than anticipated market demand here as at least part of its reasoning. Where do you think this is?
Well, the bottom line is last year EV sales were up 31%. If you look at 2020, where 2.5 million EVs were sold, if you look at 2030, the forecast is 50 million EVs will be sold. You know, we made a business decision to save the 100,000 auto workers in Ontario who are not making EVs. We're able to convert most of those plants to EVs. So this is the business decision that we made, to get into the EV market to be able to save those 100,000 jobs. Turned out we're adding about 30 or 40,000 jobs along the way.
Based on the dollar amounts associated with this, do you feel you may have spent too much on the earlier deals? People will look at $2.5 billion for the full meal deal from Honda at four different locations versus the much higher potential subsidies and the infrastructure investments for the other deals and say these don't match up very well.
Look where we were in 2019. First of all, before our government got elected, we lost 300,000 jobs in Ontario. Since we're elected, we've seen the creation of 700,000 jobs in Ontario. We saw a point in Ontario where Reuters announced there will be $300 million spent on EVs and zero was coming to Canada. So we made a decision to get into the electric vehicle industry that brought us from zero to $28 billion in announcements, and now we're at $43 billion coming into Ontario for announcements. So, you know, the earlier, the first early adopters, yes, they got different kinds of incentives as they were the first in a market that had zero, and now we'll be a well-oiled machine that people are acknowledging worldwide. Ontario is the place they need to be, and those subsidies won't get them here.
Okay. A lot of this is dependent on the transition of the market and people transitioning away from internal combustion engine vehicles to the battery vehicles and eventually the fuel cell vehicles. This part of the pressure of carbon pricing, the carbon tax, is to incentivize people to move away from gas vehicles to these electric vehicles that you're putting money into to build. And other provinces offer subsidies. You're fighting against the carbon tax, and you've cut the consumer subsidies to buy electric vehicles going back to 2018. How do those measures align with the economic hopes you're pinning on these investments if you're taking away the price pain incentive, arguably, of the carbon tax with your push, and you're not making it affordable for Ontarians to buy these vehicles the way other provinces across the country are doing?
Well, first of all, we've seen Quebec move away from the subsidies as well. From 7,000, they're going to zero in subsidies as well. But we've incentivized Ontario families in many other ways. We've lowered the price of gasoline. We've lowered all kinds of costs for Ontario families by supplying, whether it's childcare or seniors care. All of those things are part of what we've done. But we decided to use Ontario tax dollars to bring those companies here. 100,000 auto jobs are at stake. None of those companies had any plans to move from their combustion engine vehicles into electric vehicle. They would have gone. That's the blunt reality of it. So not only did we use tax dollars and help save those 100,000 workers, we've added all those tens of thousands of workers. Look at Volkswagen plant. It's going to be built, it's being constructed right now. It's going to be the fourth largest building on planet Earth. In Ontario, we have 700 parts makers, 500 tool and die and mold makers, 400 companies in the mobility sector. What happens to all those companies if we don't have those investments of Ontario into the EV sector? That's where we chose. We chose to back the workers in Ontario, put that money so they have a job.
No, I completely get it from the industrial perspective and the job creation perspective and trying to secure that you're part of the economic transition. But if you want Ontarians to move to electric vehicles to help reduce emissions, at least on you mentioned making gas cheaper. If you keep making gas cheaper and take away the federal carbon tax, that reduces the incentives for people to make the transition to non-gas burning cars, does it not? I mean, is one affordability policy working against an industrial policy in Ontario?
Well, we know that electric vehicle cars are being mandated here in Canada, in the U.S., and all around the world. But what we've done in terms of GHG emissions reductions as well, we've helped companies like Algoma Steel in Northern Ontario and DeFasco in Hamilton convert their coal-burning operations to make electric arc steel. So we have green steel here in Ontario. You look in Kentucky where they have 6% clean energy to make a battery, or other states that have 18% clean energy to make to assemble an auto. You come to Ontario, you make an electric vehicle with clean green steel, you assemble that vehicle with 94% clean electricity here in Ontario, and you make a battery with 100% clean energy. Nowhere else in the world has that kind of capacity to make those clean green electric vehicles. That's why Ontario will make our 30% reduction by 2030, likely be the only province.
Minister Vic Fedeli, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate you joining us today.
Thank you, David.
Ontario MPP Sarah Jama was asked to leave the provincial legislature today for wearing a keffiyeh, a request Jama refused.
Sarah Jama, you are named. You must leave the chamber.
Security did not physically remove Jama from question period, so she remained. The garment was banned from the chamber last week when the House Speaker ruled it represented a political statement in the midst of the Israel-Hamas war. Meanwhile, all four of Ontario's political party leaders, including Premier Doug Ford, are calling for a reversal of the ban, but so far, two attempts to do that through unanimous consent have been unsuccessful. Jama says the keffiyeh ban is racist and has pledged to continue wearing the scarf. We're going to talk about all of this with the power panel. Cameron Ahmad is a former head of communications to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Shachi Curl is the president of the Angus Reid Institute. Andrew Thompson is a former NDP cabinet minister in Saskatchewan. And Gary Keller, he's a former chief of staff to Conservative cabinet ministers. Good to see you all, gang. Happy Thursday.
Hey, David.
Shachi, this is an interesting one. The speaker has imposed this. The party leaders don't agree with it. Individual members of the legislature are refusing to give the consent to overturn it, and the speaker won't reverse his decision without that. And now we have this that played out today. What do you make of this?
The optics of today were just awful to see, you know, the speaker saying you are named Sarah Jama as three young women of color who I believe are pages. I think they were of color. I don't want to make assumptions about their identity. Looked on like, what is the message that was delivered today on so many levels? It was awful. If you're Doug Ford, it brings to mind the old quote from the time of Henry II when it came to Thomas Becket, the Archbishop of Canterbury. You know, who will rid me of this troublesome or meddlesome priest? And in this case, the Speaker of the House, although he is acting not as a functionary of the Ontario Conservatives in his role as Speaker, is creating all kinds of problems for Doug Ford as Speaker with this decision. There's nothing they can do about it. There's nothing the party can do about it or that Premier Ford can do about it in terms of forcing the Speaker to change his mind. But you do wonder, you know, do his nomination papers get signed the next time around for all of the trouble that this is causing? Every day that we have a conversation about this, we're not talking about something else that Doug Ford wants to be talking about, more like, you know, the EV plants or his roads or other things that are important to him. The challenge, too, really comes back to, and we talked about this last week, but it bears reminding and just putting down for anyone who wasn't part of that conversation with us last week. The keffiyeh is a traditional piece of clothing that dates back to the 4th century to Bedouin tribes in the Middle East. In Middle Eastern countries, there are different keffiyehs for different countries and different parts of the Middle East. And all clothing, at some point, will span and cross over and back along the line of what is cultural and what is political. A turban can be political depending on its color or the way it's worn. A kirpan can be political. Wearing a sari or another piece of cultural clothing can be seen as political depending on who's wearing it, what color it is, and what context it's being worn. Are we going to get into a place in Canada in 2024 where elected officials are, if you ban this, what's next? What comes next? Because it sets a tremendously slippery slope precedent around what gets worn in the name of culture, in the name of showing support in legislatures across the country.
So Gary, you have worked for a government house leader and a whip. The speaker seems to have done this on his own initiative. I don't know if this was a request of an MPP. I've not seen that anywhere in the reporting. And all the party leaders oppose it. How do you navigate through this if it's going to cause this continued cycle of disruption inside the second biggest government legislature in Canada?
Well, first of all, I don't think that the speaker is going to be on the premier's Christmas card list. He has a by-election next week in Milton. It's a dead heat. There was a debate in Milton, I think it was last week, where the whole issue was about Israel and Gaza. It had nothing to do with building roads or building transits or EV subsidies or building homes, which is what Doug Ford wants to be talking about. He doesn't want to be talking about this imposition that the speaker's had. I'm not a procedural expert on the Ontario legislature, but I would think that if members of the Legislative Assembly wanted to, they could overturn this ruling by a majority vote in the legislature. You could certainly in the federal House of Commons, and sometimes speakers do things. The timing for Doug Ford politically is terrible. But at the end of the day, the Ontario legislature is not going to solve Middle East peace. It's not going to solve world hunger. It's got to get back to doing the things that it should be doing. I agree that the optics were terrible. At the same time, we have had a lot of people culturally appropriating the keffiyeh in the streets, in public settings, and expressing horrible, horrible anti-Semitic views in our streets. And I think that's why the speaker probably took that action. We can debate whether he overstepped it too far, and Doug Ford and all the party leaders don't want to talk about this. But also the individual in question, you know, this is the same person who signed an open letter, who basically denied the existence of rapes of women by Hamas, that supported the release of Palestinian prisoners, which includes people who murdered Israelis and Jews. This person is looking for trouble, and they have been looking for trouble, and they got kicked out of the NDP for looking for trouble.
Right. Well, I think she was actually kicked out of the NDP because of insubordination issues with her leader, but she's still under Sarah Jamma, we're talking about, she's still under censure in the legislature, Andrew, and unable to speak unless she withdraws and apologizes for the statements she made on a social media feed, which is an interesting choice in a Canadian legislature to do that. But here she is now at the center of this. What do you make of what we saw roll out today?
I mean, let me just correct two pieces of what Gary has said. The Ontario legislature, unlike a lot of other legislatures, has really strict rules about what can and can't be worn and what permissions need to be had. It's a really odd kind of colonial mentality that sits over there. You can't wear a kilt even if you're a Scot. You can't wear your crucifixes. I mean, there's all sorts of things that you're just not allowed to do. You can't wear a daffodil pin without permission to support, you know, the Cancer Society. It's a really odd set of rules that are very old-fashioned and very out of step with Canadian politics. It is kind of ironic that the whole point of having a parliament is to allow debate, political debate and political action to happen on the floor, and that the Speaker would then argue that this, which is obviously a political statement on Jamma's part and others, you know, is banned. He's also been very selective about this, and I think this is one of the other issues. People have made a big point about how one of the other MPPs, Robin Martin, Conservative MPP, is often seen in the legislature wearing IDF dog tags in support of the Israeli forces. So, I mean, this has been a selective piece. I think there's some of that going on. The problem here is that the party leaders, and I think the vast majority of parliamentarians, legislators, want to overturn it, but they require unanimous consent to get the motion on the floor. There will undoubtedly, if it does come to a vote, I think be overturned because it is just a ridiculous ruling on the part of the Speaker. But the problem is getting it to that point, and right now you've got 3, 4, 5 holdouts on the Conservative side that are refusing to allow it to pass. Is Doug Ford able to marshal them? Is he able to get them to just, you know, go for a coffee when the vote gets called? I don't know what his ability is within his caucus to actually bring discipline. But to me, that's the other big question here, is Doug Ford losing control of his caucus, and what does that say about the state of the governing Conservatives?
Yeah, and Cameron,
to be fair, I think Robin Martin's been wearing a release the hostages necklace, not an IDF necklace.
Fair enough, but it's still a political statement, right?
Release the hostages? That's a pretty basic human rights statement.
Yeah, I'm not saying I disagree with it, but I'm saying that, you know, this is where the debate is in terms of what's allowed and what's not allowed in the legislature.
But this is the interesting thing, and not to interrupt, but to get to Cameron, it's like, whatever you think of the various political stances, Parliament has these rules about what the speakers will call props, you know, or political garments or statements. You know, it runs from, like, you know, overt protest signs to stickers on a laptop in terms of the level of, you know, grievance people bring to it. And certainly in a conflict like this, Cameron, anything that you wear, you know, related to this is going to become a flashpoint. And here we're seeing incredible disruption at Queen's Park because of this and an inability, despite a leadership agreement at the party level with the Speaker and various MPPs to move past this. I mean, where do you think this goes?
Well, I totally agree with Andrew. I mean, it's obviously all open to interpretation, and this comes across, whether it is or it isn't, it is perceived as an extremely selective interpretation of the rules, and it's targeting one group of people who feel compelled to speak up over what is objectively a completely horrific slaughter of tens of thousands of people in Palestine who are feeling at a loss for how to express themselves, and they feel compelled to do something about it. And the keffiyeh, as Shachi mentioned, is an extremely important cultural symbol for Arab Canadians, Palestinian Canadians, and again, open to interpretation whether or not it's a political symbol or not, but just an awful decision by the Speaker, and frankly, ridiculous that he hasn't reversed it yet. And those few holdouts that in the Conservative caucus in Ontario who are preventing a motion come from being passed to reverse this decision have to look beyond themselves, have to look beyond their frankly, you know, uninformed or ignorant understanding of what the keffiyeh is and understand the impact this has, the way that millions of people in this country feel attacked, stigmatized, smeared simply for who they are, for their cultural and ethnic background, or for their position right now on this conflict and, you know, their desire to express themselves. So where does this go? Hopefully, you know, last week we spoke about this. We were all in agreement, and a rare moment for the panel. Everybody agreed that it was a great thing for all the leaders of all the parties to be speaking against this and opposing it. Well, let's actually you know, let's hear them, let's put some pressure on them to actually do more and try and speak up louder and demand that this decision be reversed. I mean, sure, it's the purview of the speaker and it's his decision as to whether or not this is imposed, but the premier, his caucus, his ministers, all the other political leaders have a voice and they have a pulpit and they should be uniting themselves and completely dropping the politics from this and talking about how ridiculous, stigmatizing, insulting this decision is to millions of Canadians.
Okay, Shachi, just as a final point on this, I mean, Gary mentioned the Milton election, which has a growing and vocal Muslim population. But you look at someone like Robin Martin, who we've discussed. She's the MPP for Eglinton Lawrence, which has a significant Jewish population. And Marco Mendicino represents that at the federal level. He's also a staunch defender of Israel. So all of these political factors come into this, right, in terms of the pushing to lift the ban and the refusal to go ahead with the ban. So flash forward to a week from today. The by-election, I believe, is in Milton. If Doug Ford loses that seat, you know, what do you think this potentially does to politics in Ontario if this proves to be like a key issue in driving some of the votes there?
Well, lots of hypotheticals there, David. But I mean, we've talked about how the public opinion polling is doing two things. One, Canadians are almost evenly split, almost perfectly evenly split in terms of where their sympathies lie more, either with both sides or with one side or with the other, one third, one third, one third. And then you see the way those views pull across the political spectrum. Right of center parties identifying more to those whose sympathies lie more with the people of Israel post-attack and through the war, left of center parties more appealing to those that are more supportive of and worried about the people of Gaza through this conflict. When we talk about, and when Gary says things like Doug Ford is not an ideological conservative, that is absolutely true. It's been part of his political success, but it also speaks to the same problems that federally the Liberals have been having under the Trudeau government of trying to appeal across a political spectrum to people who have really, really almost irreconcilable views about this conflict. And so, yeah, we'll see what happens with this by-election.
Okay, gang, we're out of time, but I want to thank you for engaging on that in a respectful and calm way with each other. Cameron, Shashi, Andrew, and Gary, thanks so much, gang. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, David. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
That's it for today. If you like this episode, please follow the pod and catch our next live show on CBC News Network. We're on weekdays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm David Cochrane. Thanks for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.